My name's Roman. My talk's called Mortgage Democracy. And it came... The reason I originally wrote a little article, short article about mortgage democracy was because it was for an encyclopedia, a political science encyclopedia of democratic thought. So remember that that's the kind of context in which it was written. It was an attempt to, a quiet attempt to kind of bring some anarchist ideas in a mainstream political science sort of sphere. So the idea of a mortgage, which is obviously a contractual relationship used to buy property, has been around for about 500 years. It comes from an old French word meaning dead pledge. But while it might be an old word in modern times, it often has a pretty kind of positive connotation. I mean, if you look at this ad pamphlet from the Royal Bank of Scotland for one of their mortgages, it says freedom. Mortgages are about freedom. Our mortgage can save you money without locking you in. You can get out of jail free. There's flexibility, there's choice, you know. So the mortgage is seen as a pretty good thing. Not everybody, of course, has always thought of a mortgage as a good thing. In the 18th Brumaire, Marx writes that the feudal obligation... Sorry to quote Marx, but, you know, Kropotkin also wrote about the mortgage and credit, and our lives being mortgaged in some way, and debt being a bad thing, but he's not as quotable as Marx. Marx says, the feudal obligation that went with the land was replaced by the mortgage, and the bourgeois order has become a vampire that sucks the smallholders' blood and brains and throws them into the alchemist's cauldron of capital. And, you know, I looked for really good quotes from Kropotkin on this, and I just couldn't find them. But, I mean, Kropotkin does talk about mortgages and credit, you know, says we live in a society of credit and debt. Especially in fields, factories, workshops, tomorrow, he writes about that a lot. And I think there's an undeveloped analogy here, and that is that political systems too express mortgage relationships in a similar way to a normal kind of house mortgage is an exploitative relationship. Because people like Marx and Kropotkin were clear that, you know, a mortgage was an unequal relationship between creditors and debtors, which, you know, contributed to poverty and exploitation in some way. Now, with a political analogy, I think that that modern liberal democracies or representative democracies express two forms of mortgage relationship. One is that states are mortgaged. They're mortgaged to big business, international financial institutions, and to other states in some ways. And secondly, individuals are mortgaged. Individuals mortgage their freedom to the state and to their financial creditors. Now, there's a question I ask myself as well, why am I bothering developing this analogy, which I'll go into? And there's sort of three things that really strike me. One is to do with renewing the anarchist tradition. You know, this sort of 19th century anarchist writing about credit and debt like Kropotkin a lot, and I'm sort of interested in trying to bring that into the present in some way. Secondly, the idea of the mortgage democracy provides both, I think, you know, in some ways, a critique and an alternative to contemporary liberal democracies. Because the problem with what we have is that these political systems are mortgaged, so the alternative is to take the mortgage out of the mortgage democracy, and maybe that would require a different kind of political, social, economic system. And the third reason why I'm sort of think about or have attempted to pursue this analogy is that I think using the word democracy is a way of talking to academics, mainstream media, and that kind of thing without scaring them by using the word anarchism all over the place. You know, though I'm not 100% fixed on that idea, but it does fit here. So let me just talk a bit about mortgage states, and then I'll go into mortgage individuals. A democracy is mortgaged when its deeds are held. Its deeds are held by particular organizations or groups. And if the democracy doesn't fulfill the needs of these particular organizations or groups, that is, you know, repay the debt, you know, with interest, then those particular groups, who are the creditors, can repossess the state in some way, in the same way that you could, you know, a bank will repossess your house if you don't keep up with your payments. And I think all liberal democracies or representative democracies are mortgaged in this particular way. And let me just give some examples. You know, a couple from Latin America. In Guatemala in 1954, the CIA-backed coup repossessed the state on behalf of the United Fruit Company, Guatemala landowners, the military, Guatemala military, all of whom were challenged by the, you know, regime in power between 44 and 54. And so, you know, here we have an obvious case of kind of the repossession by creditors. I mean, more modern times, you think of, you know, a million examples. The Colombian government state is increasingly mortgaged to the United States because of U.S. funding for the Colombian military through Plan Colombia. But Colombia is also a more complicated case because it's also mortgaged in some way to local drug cartels and the domestic oligarchs, traditional ruling families. In established liberal democracies, the main way that they are mortgaged perhaps is to big business. Big business supports governments through, you know, stuff that we all know about, you know, financing political parties, promising to keep their investment in the country, and in exchange they receive interest repayments, which are generally in the form of corporate welfare, you know, tax breaks, various types of subsidies, arms contracts, cheap export credit insurance, you know, all this kind of stuff. And citizens are made responsible for paying this interest, normally through through higher taxation or through social spending cuts. So they, you know, pay the interest on behalf of big business. With respect to international financial institutions, poor countries tend to be mortgaged to the IFIs and to the rich countries which control them. You know, in exchange for receiving loans, they've had to impose structural adjustment packages, privatize, open trade, all that kind of thing, and obviously make big interest repayments, which is the most obvious sort of analogy with the mortgage. You know, it's the same as a house mortgage. These countries are repaying interest, but they're losing their autonomy, obviously, to these international financial institutions. And we can think of a million examples. Nicaragua massively indebted in the 1990s. Their ability to control their social spend, the government's ability to control social spending was almost kind of nil. They had to collapse the education system and the health system. You might say, you know, Russia at the end of the 1990s revealed its mortgage status through IFI loans being used to maintain or hold up the ailing Yeltsin regime. In some cases, the property may be deemed worthless by the creditors, and they cancel the debt. You know, you might kind of think there's an analogy there with house mortgages, though obviously a bank won't often cancel the debt. But these things sometimes happen. Also, just keeping on with the IFIs, international financial institutions, the World Trade Organization. Creates and enforces mortgage relationships. You know, poor countries have to accept the unequal rules of the wealthier countries that benefit the wealthier countries. And things like the social protest in Seattle might show that the terms of the mortgage can be renegotiated to some extent. You know, the interest payment can be changed in some way, in some degree, but the essential mortgage relationship is still there. Rich nations, too, can also be mortgaged to particularly, you know, sort of the amorphous forces of global capital. United Kingdom in 1992 had to withdraw from the European Exchange Rate Mechanism because of a whole load of sort of currency speculation that was going on at the time. So they're not immune from the problems of being mortgaged in some ways. And turning now to mortgaged individuals, the idea that, you know, individuals can be mortgaged has been used figuratively, you know, for hundreds of years as a way of expressing how our individual freedom is limited in some ways. I mean, Shakespeare wrote a sonnet about credit and debt, where he says that So now I have confessed that he is thine, and I myself am mortgaged to thy will. So in the mortgage democracy, we give up our freedom, individual freedom, to a relationship of dependence in which we make repayments to the state and to financial creditors generally. So how does this work? Again, just looking at a little Latin American example, you know, in conditions of poverty, poor people mortgage their lives at the cost of their individual freedom. And the most obvious example is bonded labor. For example, in Brazil, there are, you know, more than 60,000 people working on in agricultural estates and other places who, in exchange for, you know, who are trying to pay off their debts, they can't leave their jobs. They're held in by security guards. They're sometimes killed, you know, and there they've mortgaged their freedom and often their lives because of being beholden to financial creditors and being mortgaged as a result of their poverty and having to enter into these kind of contracts where they're at a permanent disadvantage. In these established liberal democracies, it's a little bit more complicated. Individuals mortgage their freedom to financial creditors, I think most importantly through the cultural pressure to own private property and to buy a house. Thoreau in Walden says, you know, he talks about how, you know, if you buy a house in Concord, Massachusetts in the 1840s, it takes about 10 to 15 years to pay it off. And, you know, things haven't changed that much. It often takes longer. And he says, well, the cost is not just having to pay back the money and the interest, but is the years of life which you lose in having to work to pay off that interest. The burden of civilization is those lost years of life. I mean, he says that the cost of a thing is that amount of what I will call life, which is exchanged for it. So it's a kind of loss of, not just a kind of money, but of individual freedom in some absolutely fundamental sense. In fact, you could even call it like a violation of human rights, of the right to life. He also says that, you know, a mortgage, you know, having a house mortgage promotes a sedentary lifestyle because we have all the sort of cultural pressures, feeling that we have to pay it off and we can't move, we have to stay there. So this limits, you know, freedom of movement and things like that. The penalties, of course, of not paying back your financial creditors in this case of the house mortgage are, you know, often fines, bankruptcy, and possibly incarceration by the state. And, you know, I mean, another sort of example of thinking about this is a way of thinking about it in relation to freedom is that, you know, like in Britain in the 1980s, the Thatcher government privatized council houses so council house tenants could buy houses. But in a sense, you could say, well, they were given the ambiguous freedom to be in debt. You know, they got something, but there was a definite cost of freedom there. In the mortgage, individuals are mortgaged to the state, I think, in three main ways. The first way is through taxation, which, you know, is a compulsory level levy on work or consumption. And we pay this in exchange for citizenship or right of abode. And, you know, if you don't pay your taxes, you're fined, you're sometimes incarcerated, particularly if you're poor, because obviously the rich aren't always incarcerated when they don't pay their taxes. They just can pay fines, or they get away with it, or they have good accountants. An interesting aspect of this, I think, is that a sort of shift in Europe, but also in other places, from direct income tax to indirect sales taxes on things like food and kids' shoes means that, you know, if tax is mostly on income, if you reach retirement age, you're no longer paying taxes normally, well, in some way, after you reach retirement age. So you can pay off the debt of citizenship by, you know, working to your 60 or 65, depending on the system. Also, you know, unemployed people have generally not had to pay any kind of income tax. They haven't had to bear that burden of citizenship to pay back the interest. But with a shift to sales taxes, indirect forms of taxation, people like, you know, elderly people and the unemployed can't escape these particular interest payments in the mortgaged democracy. They just go on till the day you die because you've got to eat, and so you're always, you know, paying taxes, you know, on your food. And the problem here, of course, is that we don't have control over how our taxes are used generally. You know, they're used for fighting wars or for prisons or whatever. So the problem here, it's not a question of, you know, which political party it is, but it's a question of, you know, the highly centralized state that we don't, you know, have access to and can't control. So after taxation, the second main way I think that individuals have their freedom mortgaged is through conscription or military service, which happens in a lot of countries, where you actually mortgage your life or potentially mortgage your life to the state in exchange, again, for citizenship. So on some occasions when there's a war, the state will call in the ultimate debt and make you go off and fight, and you'll probably, you know, you may well be killed for it. And again, there are big penalties for non-compliance, fines, incarceration, forced labor. I mean, there are many, you know, depends on which system, which country. The third way I think that individuals are mortgaged is just really a general point about the rule of law. You know, overall, I think the rule of law places limits on our individual freedom as the price of, you know, basic citizenship. You know, supposedly for our own good or for the general good. You know, we're banned from smoking cannabis or forced to do jury duty, or children can't control their own education. So we mortgage our individual freedom or individual sovereignty to the state. And, you know, sometimes if you have a house mortgage, you might be able to renegotiate and switch to the Bank of Scotland and get more flexibility and choice, but it's not so easy with the citizenship issue. You can't just swap countries so easily, and you could gather the testimony of 100 million refugees and find that out. and I think, you know, this is something, you know, we're all used to thinking about, you know, obeying the rule of law is so, you know, accepted that we still talk about living in a free society. But then why not ask, well, what bank would give you a loan without expecting some interest repayments, some sort of obligation, you know, in return? So how can we think about alternatives to the mortgage democracy? To mortgage citizenship and, you know, mortgage individual and the mortgage state. Well, one way to do it is to move back to the original meaning of mortgage, which is a contractual relationship to buy property. So you might ask the question, well, how have individuals tried to avoid house mortgages? One way that people have tried to do it, and lots of anarchists have tried to do it, is to avoid the unequal relationship of the house mortgage through community-run, tenant-run housing, you know, community housing, cooperative housing, self-build housing, all these kind of alternative ways of housing yourself, in which often housing is better quality than in the public sector, cheaper than in the private sector. You're often getting your loans from non-profit organizations. You may be involved in the planning or organization of the housing cooperative, and you're making more kind of decisions about your own life. And these experiences, the results of all this are experienced on the local level. So then why not extend this same idea to politics? You know, that we plan and operate politics ourselves, make our decisions more local and participatory. We avoid the intermediaries and citizenship debts of the representative system and the interests to which it's beholden. So you could kind of envision Kropotkin style a system of decentralized, federated, cooperative banks in which we make our social, political, and economic decisions. And if that were the case, we'd be holding the deeds to our own lives in the same way we'd be controlling, you know, a house, having an alternative control for our lives in respect to a house mortgage. And the final point I'll just make is that when thinking about the mortgage democracy, one shouldn't really think about the state as a thing, as a structure, which can be overthrown or replaced, but instead to think about the state as a system of mortgage relationships with individual human beings, some of whom are creditors, some of whom are debtors, some of whom are both, like, you know, a politician with a company directorship or something, you know, they cross some of these boundaries between creditor and debtor. But that, you know, our society and political systems are made up of these mortgage relationships. And it's a bit like, you know, the Gustav Landauer talking about the state as a condition, not a sort of mechanical structure or a thing in a kind of Weberian sense. And therefore, the way to challenge the political mortgage system is by forming human relationships which are not mortgaged. And instead of being mortgaged, they're relationships which are sort of local, non-hierarchical, voluntary, and based on mutual aid. That's really what I have to say on the mortgage democracy. In terms of sort of things, possible things to discuss, I mean, the two things strike me. One is that the mortgage democracy assumes that democracy in a non-mortgaged form is a desirable type of political organization. But should we really be aspiring to something that we call democracy or something different? I mean, democracy is such a dirty word, it's a meaningless word. Of course, a lot of people here, I mean, it's very striking to me that people talk about direct democracy or participatory democracy or this is what democracy looks like. But of course, historically, democracy is associated with bourgeois democracy and, you know, co-optation of workers as a form of social control and all these kinds of things. So maybe we shouldn't be talking about trying to talk about democracies, mortgaged or otherwise, and should use something else. So I'm kind of skeptical about my own this idea. I mean, I could say much more about that, but I'll leave it to you. The second thing is that in this paper, I don't really talk explicitly about anarchism very much. You know, really, I draw on a lot of sort of anarchist-style thinkers like Thoreau or whoever, but I really only mention anarchism at the very end in the actual kind of written piece I've done for this encyclopedia. And so I think there's a question about whether the anarchist content of the idea of mortgage democracy is too diluted. There's not enough anarchism in it. It doesn't stay up talk up front about anarchism, it doesn't state a formal anarchist position, but it kind of tries to lead the reader to a conclusion where they may well then be kind of receptive to or led to picking up some anarchist book and having a look at it. You know, because I do mention kind of Kropotkin and Colin Ward in the actual paper, but in a tiny way in reference to, you know, tenant-run housing and self-built housing and stuff like that as a political model. So they're the two kind of issues which I think might be interesting to discuss, but whatever. So that's what I have to say. Oh, I've got copies of the paper if you want it. I mean, whatever. Yeah.